I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. So where are we in the drama surrounding Pennsylvania's attorney general? Kathleen Kane has been charged with revealing secret grand jury information and lying about it under oath, allegations she denies. Well, more recently, on September 21st, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court suspended her law license temporarily. On October 1st, she was charged with a second count of perjury. The next day, she accused Supreme Court Justice Michael Akin of sending pornographic emails. And this week, lawyer James Barker, who was fired by Kathleen Kane after he testified in a criminal case involving her, is suing Kane for defamation. Well, John Micek is someone that we call up when we want to talk about Pennsylvania's attorney general. He's editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News and Penn Live. And John Micek, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
So how long do you think this drip, drip, drip of stories could go on?
Well, we've gone nearly 2 days without any new news in the Kathleen Kane case, which may actually be a new record. So we've got that going for us. But it's just extraordinary that you ran it down there in your opening. It seems like just when you think things can't possibly get any worse for her or any more bizarre, something goes and gets weirder and more bizarre. I mean, the one thing you left out of your very lengthy catalog was the fact that Gene Stilt, the government reform activist, is now seeking the full disbarment of Attorney General Kane and filed a complaint for the Board of the Court of Judicial Discipline this week.
Well, I ran across a number of quotes from the Attorney General. She said, "You can arrest me 2 times. You can arrest me 10 times. I'm sure this isn't the end of the game, but I will not stop until the truth comes out, and I will not stop until the system operates the way it's supposed to be." So at least at this point, John, she's standing firm.
Oh, yeah. She's not resigning. She has no intention of resigning. The one wrench, of course, thrown into the works here is the suspension of her law license, which takes effect on October the 21st, effectively rendering her sort of a popularly elected HR director. She's conceded that that could throw a wrench into her reelection plans for 2016, as if the court case hasn't made that complicated enough as well.
Well, let me, I guess, start backwards or start this week. I'm talking about James Barker here. He worked in the Attorney General's office, was there actually before she got there, was fired by Kane. Why did she fire him? Do you know?
Well, Kane's office claims it was part of a restructuring of the office and the way things worked in there. Mr. Barker claims that he was fired for testifying against her at the grand jury that eventually indicted her on the battery of charges that she finds herself facing now.
Do we know what he said to that grand jury?
You would have to ask me that. I will toggle over and look it up. It was related to sort of the conduct in the office and the grand jury leaks that she that she's accused of making, and he told the grand jury what he knew about that. There had been from people I talked to within Kane's office that there was this air of paranoia, air of suspicion that you know, we've talked about this before, about people having their desks searched, that there was this paranoid air emanating from the top of the office, and it looks like Mr. Barker got swept up in it.
And it looks like he wants reinstatement and some kind of monetary damages, and he's suing her personally, John?
Yes, that's right, and personally and officially, I think, if I recall correctly.
And then just sort of going through the list of things, on October 1st, she was charged with a second count of perjury. What did that involve?
That was related to a secrecy oath she apparently signed upon taking office in 2013, where you swear and pinky swear not to reveal any confidential information. Of course, she is charged with revealing confidential information, so that's just one more charge sort of slapped on top of it.
And investigators actually went to her office at what, to find this piece of paper that she signed?
Yeah, they served a warrant and went marching in there. My colleagues from Penn Live and other news outlets were over there to watch the show. But it's getting to be sort of a regular occurrence down there. And I would suspect they're probably on a first name basis with the investigators from the Montgomery County District Attorney's Office by now.
Well, now we get to talk about the pornography. You know, the sort of really icky kind of disgusting part of this story. But Kathleen Kane has, name this Supreme Court Justice Michael Akin and talked about releasing, what, 1,500 emails that are alleged to be either pornographic or racist or homophobic?
That's correct. And the state Supreme Court has actually retained a Pittsburgh law firm to review again the contents of these allegedly offensive emails. Kane's turned those emails over to the court and to the Judicial Conduct Board and the State Ethics Commission, sort of hitting for the cycle on that kind of stuff. I mean, these emails were the subject of a review by the court last year, we should also add, at the time that then-Justice Seamus McCaffrey was caught up in a similar situation and eventually resigned from the high court. Justice Aiken has pledged to cooperate. And to the best of my knowledge, he has not sent those, but rather received them, but he has now been caught up in this.
Well, if these emails were being investigated a year ago, why has his name come up today?
That's sort of the $1,000 question. My colleague, Brad Bumstead at the Tribune Review, talked to some folks last week who say that whenever Kane starts facing a sticky situation, she drops a cache of porn emails. It's kind of a don't look there, look over here. And as you noted at the beginning of the show, Marty, that came just a day after she was arraigned on those fresh criminal charges from Risa Furman's office.
I have to say, and I read the Daily News this morning, it looks like they have their hands at least on some of these emails, including some of the emails involving Michael Aiken. And, if what I read is true, and I have to believe that they went through them and described some of these quote-unquote jokes and sexist and racist emails sent back and forth, it's really pretty appalling.
Well, I've not seen the Daily News story this morning, I will confess, but, having seen sort of the previous cache of emails that was sent around, it's pretty gross and it's unprofessional and, it's not the kind of stuff that you would think somebody in positions of responsibility and power would be sending around, that they would simply just, they would simply know better than to do this, but yet we have this culture that apparently exists. Or existed.
I mean, and this is really the centerpiece of what she is fighting back with, saying that what she is fighting in this is this corruption of sexism and racism and homophobia.
Yeah, and that's what she's saying. That's why she was targeted, because she was going to expose those who were at the center of this. I mean, there's nothing technically illegal about any of this stuff, although they are guilty of appalling taste and insensitivity and, well, frankly, misuse of work computers, if one wants to get right down to brass tacks about it. But again, it's an image thing. I mean, these are people who are charged with protecting the most vulnerable amongst us. Apparently, targeting the most vulnerable amongst us with just horrible and offensive emails.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's John Micek, editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News and Penn Live, getting us up to speed on the charges and countercharges involving Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane. It's been a busy couple of weeks after some pretty extraordinary things that have happened over the last couple of months. Any questions or comments, call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and we'd be curious to know what you make of the saga, the drama involving Pennsylvania's Attorney General. John, now, as I understand it, Kathleen Kane is fighting some right-to-know requests coming from newspapers. Can you flesh that out for us?
Well, she had actually been fighting them. They were right-to-know requests, in fact, for the porn emails we've just been talking about here, Marty. But as I recall, she actually backed off and said she would release some of those, and hence we have them in our hands now. But, I mean, it was a bit of a clangor for a politician who has made transparency and government accountability sort of the centerpiece of her administration to simultaneously claim that this stuff was off limits and that she wasn't going to release it. And that was something we were all sort of struck by as she was fighting the release of these emails.
But the idea is, I mean, it seems like the pressure is on to release them all, put them all out there, and what? Then the public and the press can decide what's been going on?
Exactly right. And I mean, she claims she has all this stuff. She claims she wants to expose this culture of corruption, but she has been selective in the release of the emails. She has been strategic in the release of the emails, lending some credence to this idea that they can be a diversionary tactic when things tend to go south for her, which, again, seems to happen roughly about once a week these days.
I mean, her target has been Frank Fina here in Philadelphia, Mark Costanzo. They used to work for the Attorney General's office. They now work here in Philadelphia for the district attorney. He has asked that they get, or maybe required that they get, some kind of sensitivity training.
Yeah, Seth Williams, your DA down there, I guess it's the middle of – it all runs together now. So it was the middle of last month where he issued the statement saying he'd reviewed both Fina and Costanzo, these prosecutors who were at the head of the Sandusky prosecutions and some other high-profile prosecutions over the last 5 or 7 years at the state level, and apparently found they'd done nothing wrong whilst working for him, but, yeah, did order some sensitivity training. You know, and it's difficult for Williams, who's an African-American guy, to be – to have these two fellows, white fellows, working for him, who had apparently sent around racist emails, is a very, I can imagine, a very delicate and uncomfortable situation for him to be in.
You mentioned the fact that the Supreme Court did suspend her law license temporarily. That's effective later this month. You said that, in a sense, it renders her more like an HR person than the Attorney General. Meaning what? She cannot do some of the things that she's been doing now?
Yeah, I mean, you have to, in order to be the attorney, to be Attorney General, one must be a practicing and licensed lawyer. So if your license is suspended, it constrains all kinds of things. You can't sign warrants. You can't sign off on some legal paperwork. Her hands are tied in some fairly meaningful ways.
Is the legislature going to do anything? You mentioned Gene Still, but he's not a member of the legislature.
It seems like he is some days, but no, he's not.
I realize that.
Sort of ex officio to the General Assembly. The Senate, the state Senate, actually has the power. It's kind of a nuclear option to move to remove her without having to go through the ordeal of an impeachment trial, which would have to begin a proceeding that would have to begin in the House, just like we see at the federal level. The articles of impeachment would have to be brought in the House, and she'd have to have a trial in the Senate, and that would be a lengthy process. Although there is constitutional language apparently where the Senate could act unilaterally to remove her, and again, that's kind of a nuclear option. And while they've sort of talked about it in the abstract, from what I can tell, there is no interest in doing that right now.
Does she have any allies?
They are disappearing quickly.
Really? Really?
Yeah, I imagine it's fairly lonely to be Kathleen Kane these days. Governor Tom Wolf has called on her to step down. You have newspaper editorial boards, including our own, who are calling on her to step down. Democratic political allies seem to be few and far between. So were she even to run, be able to capably run for re-election, it is hard to envision what network of support she could tap for that election bid.
We have to end on that note. John Micek, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Marty, anytime.
He's the editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News and Penn Live. And do stay with us as we continue Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Our guest is Jim Foster, independent candidate for mayor of Philadelphia. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Our guest, Jim Foster, ran for Philadelphia City Council in 2007 and ran for Congress, challenging incumbent Shaka Fatah in 2012. He lost badly both times. Well, this year he's running for mayor of Philadelphia as an independent candidate. He's the publisher of Germantown Newspapers Incorporated and a lifelong resident of the Germantown section of Philadelphia. He has railed against the one-party machine in Philadelphia and what he calls corruption in city government. He has a 10-point platform that begins with accepting the resignation of all appointed officials. Today we feature the first of 5 one-on-one interviews with the candidates for mayor of Philadelphia. And Jim Foster, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty, and good morning to you and the listeners to Radio Times.
And let me give out that phone number to join our conversation. Any questions for our guests, call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Why do you think this time is going to be different from the other times that you ran? When you ran for city council, you got 590 votes against Shaka Fatah, 4,000 votes. Why is this year different?
First of all, let me clarify a point. I didn't make the decision to get in this race in advance The other two races, I wanted to make a statement. And, of course, I'm a lifetime independent. I don't just convert for convenience to get around the system. And I've had perspectives that I have focused on pretty aggressively over the years. And in the other two races, I wanted to get a message out.
So you weren't really running?
Well, I was running, but I didn't really have the thought that the information I was going to be conveying to the public was going to get a very big reception.
So this is a real campaign as opposed to
the
other
ones? Well,
it's
a real campaign, but it was brought about by frustration with two well-known, recognized people who claimed they were going to be independents and be candidates, and they wimped out.
And Sam Katz,
and Bill Green. Both of these folks who are well-recognized, they're established, they could have easily brought, you know, funding and a backup system to them. They both converted to independent, made it known, said they were going to run for mayor, then changed their minds, then said they were going to run for city council at large, changed their minds. And, you know, that primary I'd have to say, a primary where only 27% of the eligible voters turn out, and then the mayor-elect, quote, mayor-elect, winds up winning with 12%. And then, you know, credible individuals walk away and so incensed me that with 18 days to go, that's when I decided to run. I had the 18 days to get my signatures, and I collected 3,600, and I'm on the ballot.
What do you see as the number one issue facing this city?
The theme of my campaign is Philadelphia has had the widest gap between the haves and the have-nots for a number of years running. 27% of the residents of Philadelphia live in poverty. We also have the title of having the largest amount of that percentage living in deep poverty in the nation, and that's about 13%. This city, that's an incredibly bad track record. So we have essentially a one-party government that's been in control for 60-some years. No real pushback from the other supposedly major party. And unfortunately, in my opinion, not enough reporting from the press, the mainstream or secondary press, on the serious challenges that face this city. The city is top-heavy with one of the most expensive municipal governments in the United States. That's documented.
Well, let me stop you there because I want to focus on this issue of poverty and deep poverty. I think everyone would agree that's a serious problem in the city. And while there's been a little bit of movement, pretty incremental, I would say. But what would you do to address this income divide and this deep poverty in this city?
Well, the first thing you have to do is stop spending reckless money on overpaid bureaucrats and a city council that is much bigger than it needs to be. You know,
but that's several hundred million dollars. I mean, that's not going to solve the problem of poverty in this city.
Solving the problem of poverty is not something that's accomplished overnight. First of all, you have to realize that there's a reason to take a step in that direction. My claim is that our government isn't even thinking about it and is not prioritizing it, is not characterizing it legitimately for what it is, and basically pretending that it really isn't much of an issue. Let's look over here. I call it distraction government.
Well, and we did a show earlier this week on deep poverty, and we had a member of Mayor Nutter's administration, and her job essentially is to try to figure out how to get people employed, how to get jobs that actually pay, and how to break some of this cycle of poverty. Mm-hmm. Not enough, you're saying?
Well, not even beginning to be enough. And again, city has a budget, and there's a certain amount of revenue that comes in. How that revenue is spent and how outside grants from the state and the feds are spent is what has to be looked at. Because, look, we're going to have to energize private-public partnerships of some type to bring back legitimate, decent-paying employment base. We don't have that here. We have nothing close to that here. And we've chased most of that out of this city over the last 25, 30 years. Nobody has come back to restart replacement businesses. And one of the reasons that is the case is because our taxes are so discouraging to business. The wage tax is a business killer. Everybody knows it.
Well, and clearly there's been a lot of talk about that. But what do you then make of the so-called renaissance here in Philadelphia? I shouldn't say so-called. I mean, it's clear not in some of these poor districts, but you look at downtown Philadelphia, you look at some of the neighborhoods around downtown, and it's a very different city than it was a generation or two ago. Much more lively, much more engaged.
There's pockets of progress, and there's pockets where the comfortable elite and the millennials live, and then there's the part that nobody talks about. You know, I would suggest that anyone who wants to get a real picture of Philadelphia, take a trip to Southwest Philly. Get on a commuter train in any direction and ride it till it gets outside the city, then get back and ride it back in and look out the window on both sides. You will see the ruins of what was once a city that employed, by the way, this city, the employment mix in this city was as diverse as could be. We were the city with the largest amount of homeowners as a percentage of its population in the nation for many years. Those communities have literally been destroyed. The opportunity base is gone, and there's nothing other than a little manicuring around the edges taking place to change it.
I was doing some reading about you. You have charged that the city has a higher level of corruption today than it did in the 1950s when the Republicans essentially ran the city or ran the government. Well, an example of that?
Well, you know,
that was in a newspaper article.
Absolutely. The joke in Philadelphia is that we change political parties either every 65 or 70 years, whether we need to or not. Now, the political machine that ran it until 1950, what brought it to its knees was a couple of years of aggressive investigations, indictments, convictions, and then the minority party then were the Democrats. You know, we had a Republican registration here in 1950 that was almost 70%. So lots of folks changed party in that election, and they threw out everybody but the controller in one election. The reason that took place was there was so much obvious corruption. So many people were found guilty and convicted. And, Marty—
Is that what it takes?
We're there again. We're there. Look how many people have been indicted, convicted, are serving time in the last 5 or 6 years.
In city government, in another administration or in city council?
In a part of city government. 4 state reps. 5 court judges. They closed down a municipal court.
But that's the court system. That's the legislature system.
They're all part of the political system. This is a one-party political system, completely arranged from the Democratic City Committee and all that's affiliated with it. There hasn't been a competitive race in this city in many, many years. Maybe you might say for a judge here or there, but not for any of the serving offices. The machinery that runs the city is corrupt to the bone. It runs a cover-up system to cover up the problems, but the onion is getting peeled. And by the way, the U.S. congressman is now indicted and going to be going to trial.
But again, that's not part of the Nutter administration. That's not part of city council.
No. Just because they're not part of it doesn't mean they're not derelict in their duty. Let's take a reality check here.
But what could a mayor Foster do about that?
Mayors don't work in a vacuum. Let's take the fact that this city is divided down the center of Broad Street with 2 congressional districts. The worst dependency part of the city is in the 2nd congressional district, which was Chaka-Fatas. He had 12 terms. Wouldn't you think that a mayor of a city with challenged problems would have sat down with his fellow party member, the U.S. congressman, and said, what can we do together to jumpstart serious opportunities and businesses in all the parts of your district which are the lowest and have the worst poverty? It never even happened. Chaka-Fatas was the appropriations chair for the U.S. Congress. He could very easily have done something to start at the bottom to correct the problems. But instead, and I checked this out when I ran, for the entire year from September of 2011 till 2012, and I ran for office.
And this is 2012.
I ran for office in that year. Chaka-Fatas appropriated $1 million a week to the University of Pennsylvania and almost nothing to the dependent communities of Philadelphia in his district.
But he's not running for mayor of Philadelphia.
No, the point is when the mayor doesn't even think to call up the congressman and say, what can we do to direct this federal money to where it's most needed? Hey, U of P can raise money from their alumni pretty easily. I don't think they need $1 million a week.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Jim Foster. He is running for mayor of Philadelphia as an independent candidate. And as I said at the beginning of our interview, the first of five one-on-one interviews with the candidates for mayor of Philadelphia. There are five of them, and you can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. What you make of Jim Foster's candidacy, what you would like a Mayor Jim Foster to do as mayor of Philadelphia, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @whyyradiotimes. Let me ask you about pay to play, and I think credit should be given to he was then city councilman Michael Nutter, now mayor of Philadelphia, who pretty much eliminated the kind of pay to play system that we had in this city that allowed law firms and insurance firms and developers basically to write big checks to candidates. That system pretty much has gone away. Does he get credit for that?
Well, certainly those kinds of things were overdue, and I don't think it was just Mayor Nutter that realized that. I think there were investigations and you know, potential litigation and ethics boards of various types that were already focusing on those things. And the fact that they wrote a document that said we're not going to do this anymore hasn't really stopped that from happening.
Apparently it has stopped that. In fact, some are complaining that they don't have the kind of cloud and access that they had in previous times.
Well, there's other ways of doing it now. I mean, you can argue about election rules that were ruled from the Supreme Court that allow you to do things that seemed to be one step beyond that, but it still puts the money out there, and in many cases there are organizations and law firms in this city that profit very nicely from the fact that they're politically connected. Just because they didn't make the contributions the same way doesn't mean they're not making them another way, and doesn't mean they're not benefiting from them. You know,
are you talking about illegal contributions?
I'm not saying it's illegal. But what I'm saying is, when you have one party only, no competition, a press that doesn't report enough, and you can still find a way to take big chunks of money and support the outcome of an election. And that's what's going on. It absolutely is still going on. And by the way, no bid contracts that are approved by city officials are the way the quid pro quo happens, even though it's not written on a piece of paper.
What would you do about the Philadelphia School District? As we all know, like, frankly, districts across the state facing serious budget shortfalls. There have been layoffs. There have been school closures, class sizes having to increase in order to accommodate the lack of funds. What do we do about that?
The school district problem is not a new one. It's been a festering sore in this city for years. As far as I'm concerned, there's yet to be any real transparency and legitimacy about how the money is spent in the school system. We don't know all the details, but we can't just say that this problem exists this year. The practice of delivering to the city a bill for the schools and saying, give us the money, find it somewhere, and then we'll all go home and do it again next year. That has to end.
But that's really not a correct description of how it goes. I mean, city council is involved. You've got a school reform commission. They have hearings. I mean, people may not be happy with the result, but I don't think it's quite untransparent as you say.
Well, I think it is. I think it isn't as transparent as it should be. I'm not saying that I think the school reform commission has been reforming. You know, we have two organizations in this city that were structured by the state as bailouts for major city catastrophes, and I don't think either one does their job, the SRC or the PICA board. Both of those are state created because of major disasters in financially related, and mostly, and neither of them are doing the kind of work they should be doing, from my experience.
And I do want to talk about the PICA board, but what do you think about Superintendent Height?
I think that bringing in someone with a track record in straightening out problems elsewhere doesn't necessarily mean that he is going to be able to have, shall we say, enough power to really get to the meat of the problems. And there's still too much politics in the SRC itself and in the influence over the SRC. One of the things that I think would be a step in the right direction with the school system is this. And you know, I in one of my in one of my lifetime careers, I was a banker for First Pennsylvania Bank. And I was in the department that handled some of the most critically problematic big accounts. One of the things we would do when a major entity was failing is to try to find a way to keep it from going under. And if it owned real estate, the first thing you did as the bank taking control of the problem, and let's assume that that's where, is you separate the real estate from the operations. The city of the school system owns a tremendous amount of real estate, much of it underutilized. Why should all the cost of that real estate be part of the regular city budget for the school system? It shouldn't be. What should happen, in my opinion, is that all the real estate should be spun off to a separate real estate trust by a board of independent, non-political people to run it, with the purpose of selling off all the unneeded real estate in an orderly manner, not a political manner. Let me finish. But that board would then lease back to the school system only the square footage it needs to run the classrooms at a reasonable market rate, so that when you prepare the operating budget of the school system, you don't have an overblown cost of real estate built into it. They should only be paying for the number of rooms they need at a market rate. Then the operating budget will be more realistic. Now, there's other things that need to be done in the school system, like no-bid contracts for provisions that are wasteful, and I'm a witness to it. I mean, the city of Philadelphia spends an awful lot of money for food that is thrown away because they've—
You're going to make children eat their lunch?
No. They're not thrown away for that reason. They're thrown away because when the truck comes next week, you'll take all this food and you'll throw away the other stuff, even though the dates are good.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Jim Foster. He is running for mayor of Philadelphia, one of five candidates this fall. He is running as an independent candidate. And again, to join our conversation, call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with a publisher and independent candidate for mayor of Philadelphia, Jim Foster. We've been talking about some of the changes that he'd like to see at City Hall, some of his frustrations with how city government is run. And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments for our guest, Jim Foster? You have here, and I printed it out, your platform bullet points for your platform. Mm-hmm. Bullet point number 8 says, demand that the PICA board publish summaries of all scheduled meetings on the web and in print with prominent public disclosure. The PICA board oversees the budget process in the city as a result of the bankruptcy of a number of years ago. I actually went to the PICA board's website, and here are the list of the meetings. There are minutes online. I mean, all the things that you're asking for with PICA seem to already exist.
Well, certainly it exists, and it's a very structured organization. It was a state mandated board, and it has to perform under certain guidelines on a regular basis. Unfortunately, the results of what it studies and does rarely ever make it to the public domain. I think PICA has to do a better job of making sure that this information is disseminated.
I mean, here, I'm holding it in my hand. I mean, yeah. If you go to their website, it's there.
If you go to their website is the clue here. Folks don't know to go to their website. And this is part and parcel of what I say, that the information transmitted about the – this is the nucleus of our city. The PICA board has to review the annual city budget and a 5-year forecast of how it's going to spend money for 5 years going out. Frankly, I attend those board meetings. At one time, there used to be a number of people from the press there. Now there may be two, myself and the Inquirer reporter. The coverage of it is minimal, but the PICA board doesn't even try to disseminate
But beyond their – I mean, how do you suggest they further disseminate this information? As I said, I'm holding it in my hand. It's extensive. Got it right here.
Well, I wouldn't. Considering
board meeting, annual meeting, fiscal 2017, notice of PICA board meeting, City of Philadelphia tax revenue update for August 2015.
Notice of a meeting and effectiveness of what happens there are two entirely different things.
But you're calling for them to publish summaries of all scheduled meetings on the web.
I'm calling for them to be published prominently in every possible way. And I'm calling, by the way, if we had a vital opposition political party and we had a more aggressive city press, covering what the budget is spending its money on would be a number one focus. The fact that this city has one of the most expensive governments in the nation, we have one city employee for every 51 residents. Almost no city has a ratio that high. And by the way, it doesn't even include the SEPTA workers. There are a few cities that have a lower number, but all their transit workers are included, like in New York. So our city spends money in a disproportionate way. And the PICA board, in my opinion, does not properly address the debt structure. It does not disclose the challenges that are facing it, like the pension situation. I attend the meetings. They talk about the critical pension situation, which, by the way—
And what would you do about that? I mean, I think everyone agrees this is a critical pension situation.
Well, first of all, you have to transmit to the public how critical it is. The Philadelphia pension earned 0.7% on its investments last year. 0.7%, and the PICA board spent 30 seconds discussing that. I was there. They don't seem to be all that concerned about the fact that it may be the worst in the nation, and the actuarial oversight of the outside reporting on that is very minimal. What I'm saying to you is the PICA board should be reluctant to approve these budgets. And by the way, the city controller has—
You think they're a rubber stamp?
Yes. The city controller in 2 out of the last 3 years recommend they not approve it. They not approve it. Their own internal staff recommended they not approve it. And when they come to the meetings, they spend a little bit of time talking about the meat and potatoes, a lot of time talking about peripheral issues, and it just gets passed and everybody forgets about it.
Let me ask you about number 6 on your list here. Reassess the concept that certain classes of city employees have been given exemption from city residents with intent that those exemptions be repealed. Sounds like what you're saying is that if you want to teach in the city, if you want to fight fires, be a police officer, you have to live in Philadelphia.
I don't see anything wrong with that. You know, that was a requirement that went way back to Republican days when they ran the city. And that's one of the reasons why we had so many decent neighborhoods, because everyone who worked for the city lived in it. And the idea that I understand they broke that rule down for the teachers a few years ago and now have added on the firemen and the police. I do not think that's a movement in the right direction. The city neighborhoods are best stabilized when the folks who earn their living and they're going to be paid pensions into eternity. Why should we let those folks live outside the city, not pay all the taxes that everybody else does, and get, you know, nice compensation and drop programs and pensions out in Bluebell? I just don't think that is a focused way to put remedial steps back into bad decisions of the past.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. And it looks like we have Meredith from Chestnut Hill joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Meredith. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you very much, and appreciate this show and the ones to come on the different candidates.
Sure.
In fairness, I should tell you that I have worked for Jim in the past at his newspaper, and I applaud his programs that he's putting forth here and his ideas. I think they're absolutely excellent. Philadelphia needs just this kind of cleanup. It's a mess. And talk about poor. When you take the train from Chestnut Hill West into Philadelphia, which I do frequently, when I go through North Philadelphia, I really cry. It's just disgusting. And I remember when it was.
Well, Meredith, I wouldn't use the word disgusting. I mean, you're talking about people that actually live in this particular neighborhood. I'm gonna move on, but let me give Jim a chance to weigh in on what you had to say.
I think what Meredith's referring to, and I think this is the more fair characterization, the railroad system that goes through the city into downtown doesn't go through residential houses. It goes through all the factories and business. Remember, when they built those railroads, the factories were on both sides.
Right.
They were what has happened is all of those potential places of employment, that used to pay real estate taxes and wages, and all of those are crumbling. That's what you see from the train. You see the economic engine of the city crumbling. I don't think Meredith's talking about the residents. I think she's talking about what you do visibly see is a whole crumbling infrastructure of buildings. And by the way, very little of that real estate is contributing to the tax base in any way.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times, Meredith. I mean, are you talking about bringing back, you know, industrialization? I mean, that was really the engine of a generation or two ago in Philadelphia.
Philadelphia had one of the most diverse economic opportunity zones in the city. Yes, we did have some smokestack industry, but we weren't Pittsburgh by any stretch of the imagination. And also, the job opportunity in Philadelphia wasn't all blue collar. In addition to manufacturing, light, heavy, we had transportation, packaging, you know, textile trade, light manufacturing, and a tremendous amount of white collar jobs. All those jobs at Provident Mutual Insurance out of 46th and Market were white-collar jobs. In the Insurance Company of North America, banks, administrative offices of major national corporations were all here. So our employment base was not just blue-collar that was obsolescent by time. Those businesses were chased out of here by political decisions, not by obsolescence.
What kind of political decisions? Then we'll get back to our callers.
Incredibly high taxes and shakedowns is what drove them out. Businesses don't leave just because 1 year doesn't look good. After they look at their books year after year after year and see the cost of doing business in Philadelphia was higher than competitive anywhere else, they picked up and went. Some of them just went across the city line. Mm-hmm. Some of them went – not that many really went overseas. A lot of them just went south and southwest. But they got out of town because the tax base and the way the political system was treating them was no longer – an invitation.
Let me get Walter from West Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Walter, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Mr. Foster, you seem like a breath of fresh air that we really could use in office. And to that question, point one.
Let's just do point one. Walter, let's just do point one, okay, because we've got a lot of people that want to join us. Go ahead.
Oh. I was wondering why you were running as an independent and not in either of the two parties.
Fair enough. Thanks.
Good question. First of all, I'll be honest with you. I started digging into the inside of Philadelphia's political operations almost 15 years ago when I joined a community organization in the neighborhood where I had my business. And I became an officer in that community organization. And that's when I got the firsthand exposure as to just how manipulative the government was with its own citizens. First, I went to the – now, I knew that the Democrats then had – you know, still now and then had a significantly higher voter registration. But I was from a family of all Truman and Roosevelt Democrats. You know, both sides. There was no Republicans in my family. But I registered independent when I was young because I really didn't have a specific focus on which was the better way to go. And, I've been around for a few years. So I started going to the Republicans' meetings. Just as, all right, these would be the opposition folks, and they should be anyway. Well, after about a year of trying to find a Republican that was focused and an organized party that was challenging anything, I said, forget about it. Forget about it. Once I switched my party, once, to Democrat, and ran for committeeman in my neighborhood.
How'd you do?
I had all the right signatures, and the standing committeeman did not. A judge, a paid-off judge, threw me out. I went back to independent, and I'm not looking back.
Let me go back to your bullet points here. Number five, demand that the building trade unions using their funds finance a major overhaul of the vocational school network in the city, creating a direct path to apprentice programs focusing on racial, gender, and ethnic balance. Now, the building trades, I mean, they do have an apprentice program. It may not be as aggressive as you would like it to be. But how could Mayor Foster make that happen? How can you make the building trades do this?
Well, the nice thing about it being an independent mayor is you don't have a long list of patronage people waiting for jobs and assignments. I can appoint anybody I want to those slots. That doesn't, by the way, when I ask for resignations, that doesn't mean I'm going to take all of them. But that's commonly –
And that's number one on
that's
your
commonly
list.
Done. But – people can be appointed who have insight and and a focus on what the needs of the city are. Look, I've said this before in print, and I used to have my own radio show, and I've said this before. The trade unions in Philadelphia are protectionist and, in my view, racist. It's been far too long where minorities, gender exclusion is the way it operates. And at the same time, the school system has allowed its vocational schools, which were, by the way, some of the best in the nation, has allowed them to deteriorate. There's this undercurrent philosophy that, well, the only wave of the future is high tech. Well, guess what? When you have as many unemployed people as we have here, we have a number of impoverished neighborhoods. Let's talk about what's going to work soon, and not 15 years down the road. So I say, let the trade unions, who are very comfortable financially, let them fund. This is a double-barrel win because they fund the restructuring of the vocational schools quickly, and it can be done. Plenty of real estate. Get that done, mm-hmm. and then they have to create an existing joint program. Their apprenticeship program is actually linked to the vocational schools program, and there's people with oversight that make sure that the equality of opportunity is a key part of how that happens. 2 or 3 years down the road, you got a lot of employed people at decent wages.
Let me get Mike from Germantown to join us on Radio Times. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Lou, thank you.
Sure.
And I agree with the other caller. Jim is certainly a breath of fresh air. It's nice hearing some straight information instead of all these platitudes. But my concern is that the current administration, in an effort to not to be seen as raising taxes, continues to invent more fees and fines, just chasing business out of the city, like stormwater management fees, for instance, or a reassessment of real estate, and that was not revenue neutral like state law requires. I thought maybe
you know, Mike, I hate to do this to you only because I'm watching the clock and we're going to have to say goodbye to our guest in just a couple of minutes. Do you have a specific question for our guest?
Yeah, I ask him if he thinks that the first step in when you're in a hole is to stop digging, which is what appears that the administration's doing.
Thank you. Thanks, Mike. Here's the point. The tax structure is one of the first things that's on my plate to deal with. We pay almost 50% of our city budget with a wage tax. No other city in the country does that. Boston, a city most like us, pays 80% of it with real estate taxes.
There have been efforts to slowly reduce the wage tax in the city.
But it's going nowhere. And the reason is because the wasted land in this city that pays no taxes, we only use 16% of our budget is paid for by the real estate taxes. That's because the whole real estate system is twisted up in politics. The city owns far too much real estate and does nothing with it. So what it does is it creates these inventive taxes elsewhere to compensate for the fact that it doesn't have a realistic approach to all the land that's due. Doing nothing.
What about the land? We're almost out of time here, but isn't that what the land bank is supposed to do?
The land bank is a theory, and it probably could work if it wasn't twisted up in politics and in a city council that has 7 more members than it needs. Let me close with this.
Go ahead.
When the city council was last restructured in 1951 charter change, we had just hit 2.2 million population, highest we ever had. We grew during the Second World War and the Depression. We didn't lose. That's when they needed 17 people. We don't need that today with 1.5 million people. 10 is enough. 6 districts and 4 at large, and that's a fresh start.
Jim Foster, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And he is running for mayor of Philadelphia as an independent candidate. And this is the first of 5 interviews we'll be doing with candidates for mayor of Philadelphia over the next few weeks. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program. You can, what can you do? You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook and you can follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.